Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, April 27th, 2017. Trump rolls out a one-page summary of the proposed tax reform, which is a bunch of tax cuts for the rich, a few crumbs for the rest of us, and a plan that would widen the huge existing gap between rich and poor, those with wealth, those without, those with big incomes, those with measly incomes. And as David K. Johnston told us in our recent in-depth interview, Trump's tax reform would benefit Trump himself as much, if not more, as any American. And this sordid conflict of interest that he has, this self-interest that he is using the presidency for, is a low point in American history. Now, I've been around for a long time, and every time a president proposes tax reform, the reform doesn't happen, but cuts do. The deficit is run up, wealthy people pocket more money, middle income and lower class people get hurt, and the Republicans have this Groundhog Day approach that this time the tax cuts are going to produce more revenue. And everybody knows that is a joke. And Steven Mnuchin, the Wall Street banker who fronted the unveiling of this minuscule proposal yesterday, he played the same game. Oh, yeah. You know, you cut rates and more money will come into the Treasury. Now, the Reagan tax cuts didn't do it. The George W. Bush tax cuts didn't do it. And from what we've seen of this package, this won't do it either. So it really, you know, we were told there was going to be this big rollout of this major proposal. And it's really just a statement of goals from the wealthy, what they'd like to extract from this process. And they're going to send it over to Capitol Hill and to the various special interests, mostly represented by Republicans, but not exclusively. We'll chew on it and modify it. And what comes out will be something that might resemble what goes in, but not so much, you know. And when you hear plans to cut the alternative minimum tax, that's the only reason that on the only tax returns we've seen of Trump's 2005, Johnston told us that he saved a boatload, tens of millions of dollars that he had to pay because of the alt-min tax. And if that is wiped out, he will benefit quite a bit. And the other proposal here is to reduce the tax rate on pass-through entities, partnerships, LLCs, S-corporations. And wealthy people, smart people with tax lawyers, know how to set up these entities so that it helps them evade and avoid many income taxes that they would otherwise have to pay, and at a very much higher rate. So this is a huge gift to the Republican base, and the only thing we can hope that will deflect it or really change it in any principled way is if the Republican deficit hawks, who were so upset at the money that Obama spent to try to regain control of the economy after the Republicans' reckless policies took it to the brink? Well, I doubt if they will stand on principle. They're going to follow the pack, pander to the base, pocket the money that comes from the wealthy people who will benefit from the tax cuts, and reward their favorite members of Congress. So as we see this roll out, now there could be offsetting rules that minimize the actual bottom line benefits. But I doubt it. It's going to be a bunch of smoke and mirrors. And when they talk about increasing the standard deduction so that most people wouldn't even have to file Schedule A and would simplify their tax reporting, well, not only will they have to get a standard deduction that takes into account their mortgage interest deduction, but also property taxes are on Schedule A. And based on the description so far, you're going to lose the deduction for property taxes. This guts the incentive for home ownership, which is a central feature of the American tax system. And you're going to hear howls from the mortgage community, from real estate brokers, and they will go to work with their lobbyists to change this plan. So it's not dead on arrival, but it shows what their intentions are. And in its lead editorial today, the New York Times headlines President Trump's laughable plan to cut his own taxes. He said the skimpy one-page tax proposal released on Wednesday is, by any historical standard, a laughable stunt by a gang of plutocrats looking to enrich themselves at the expense of the country's future. Two of Trump's top lieutenants, Mnuchin and Gary Cohn, both multimillionaires and former Goldman Sachs bankers, trotted out a plan that would slash taxes for businesses and wealthy families, including Trump's, in the vague hope of propelling economic growth. And there are no numbers, no projections, no idea of what this plan would actually cost. And they don't even bother to create some sort of a chart or a graph to explain their embrace of the Laffer curve, that lower rates will produce more revenue for the Treasury. So, this is an opening round. And we know that Trump is a bluffer. He loves to hit the table and demand everything. And that's what he's done here. Meanwhile, they're jockeying for position on Capitol Hill, with threats being tossed back and forth between Democrats and Republicans about a possible government shutdown tomorrow. At this point, I would say a shutdown is unlikely because Republicans have quietly introduced a short-term spending measure that would essentially be a Band-Aid to get them week to week until they can build some sort of consensus and stop the jockeying between Democrats and Republicans. The Republicans are holding hostage funding for subsidies for Obamacare insurance recipients. And they're saying, if you don't go along with the demands that we have, and they've dropped the plans for, or the demand for money for the border wall, then, they're both playing brinksmanship and seeing who will blink on the brink first. But at this point, I think we'll avoid a government shutdown, at least in the next 48 hours. Meanwhile, Jared Kushner, the golden boy, who just a few weeks ago was getting all of this favorable coverage, these fawning reports about, who he is and how he's this bright young man and that Donald relies so heavily on him. Well, he's now getting sucked into a scandal of his own. This relates to his family business, the Kushner Companies. Now, he said that he has stepped down from the Kushner Companies, but he is still receiving payments from them. He still has an interest, an ownership interest, that will survive whatever service he offers us at the White House. But what we're learning, and I give Rachel Maddow credit, she did a good job of describing this complicated picture on her Wednesday night broadcast. And essentially, a family based in Israel, the Steinmetz family, described as billionaires, led by Benny Steinmetz, they are under scrutiny by law enforcement authorities in four countries for offering bribes for a concession for iron ore in the African nation of Guinea. And despite this investigation, which has been going on for several years, the Kushner Companies borrowed heavily from the Steinmetz family, including Benny and his son Raz. One deal, they borrowed $50 million for some apartments in New York, East Village, West Village, and Soho. And even after these investigations opened up, the Kushner Company continued to do business with the Steinmetz, even though they did quietly remove any mention of the Steinmetzes from their website. So it's a complex story. As I said, Rachel Maddow did a good job of explaining it. And we will be following it here at the Peter B. Collins podcast. Another investigation that's really going deeper is the one into Mike Flynn, who was Trump's first national security advisor. And it now has surfaced with documents provided by Congressman Elijah Cummings of Maryland, who serves on the Oversight Committee. And he went public with his Republican chair yesterday, demanding documents from the White House. But he also surfaced a document of his own, a letter sent to General Flynn after the time that he left the Defense Intelligence Agency. It was dated in October of 2014, more than a year before Flynn accepted a $45,000 speaking fee from RT, the Russian-based television news network. And he failed to get permission to receive the payment. Then he took the money. Then he failed to report it. Now, these are fairly serious violations, but will the Justice Department pursue them? Will congressional oversight committees chase down this guy who left the Republican administration in disgrace? I'm dubious. And Jason Chaffetz, who I mentioned, has announced that he won't seek re-election next year, and he also dropped that he will be away for a few weeks recovering from a medical emergency that is not further described. There were hints that he might even resign as quickly as last week, but that has not come to pass. So the Flynn investigation has reached a serious stage. And like I say, it'll be very interesting to see just how the political appointees in Washington today deal with it. Every day I like to stop for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscription money. People like Mark Brodsky, Billy Cook, Jeffrey Stewart, Terry Paris. They're staunch supporters of this podcast. Many of them go on Facebook and evangelize for me. I really appreciate it. And I'd like you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and in just a couple of minutes, you can pick the level that you're comfortable with and be a strong supporter of Peter B. Collins. I appreciate it. And my loyal subscribers get first access to our new in-depth interview with journalist Trevor Aronson, whose impressive four-part series that is currently available at The Intercept is a must-read. Aronson's the guy who wrote the book Terror Factory, and 3-4 years ago he said that there were only about 5 cases of domestic terrorism prosecution that were free of the taint of government wrongdoing, a paid informant, a frame-up, sting operation, that sort of thing. And today, I asked him, now that there are just under 800 people who have been prosecuted for terrorism in this country since 9/11, how many of those people were an actual threat of violence?
I mean, you can count on, you know, your two hands the number of cases where you could fairly say that this person, you know, presented an imminent threat, you know, had the capacity, had the weapons, and had a plan. You know, an example would be Najibullah Zazi, who, you know, was in Denver making backpack bombs and had largely completed those backpack bombs and was planning to drive them across the country to New York and plant them on the subway. You know, that's an example. But there are not many. I mean, we're talking about a dozen cases where you can point to that of the nearly 800 terrorism defendants who have been charged since 9/11.
As I mentioned, the full interview with Trevor Aronson is available today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com and most of our outlets. And we go into some depth about the very powerful package of stories that he recently posted. He worked on them for over a year. He updates us on cases like the Liberty City 7, these guys in Miami who just were going for money. They didn't really think they were involved in any kind of a terrorist plot until, of course, they got arrested and prosecuted. He also talks about the revolving door of domestic terrorism suspects, including one who he takes seriously as a real terrorist threat. His name was Zazi, and he's the guy from Denver who was loading up explosives that he wanted to plant on the subways in New York City. And he pled guilty 7 years ago, and he is still not in prison, which means that he has become an undercover informant himself. And Aronson points out the abject unfairness that some of these people who've been framed and caught up in these sting operations cannot plea bargain for a shorter sentence because they weren't actual terrorists. They don't have anybody else who they can turn on and testify against. And so the people who are most innocent, if not completely innocent, are getting very long stretches in prison. We talk about how many of these cases end in a guilty plea so that we never see the evidence that would have been presented in court. It's a wide-ranging conversation about American law enforcement and political theater in the post-9/11 world, and I hope you'll find the time to listen to it. Yesterday was the field trip for every member of the Senate. They had to hop on a bus, go over to the White House, and sit through a briefing about the threat posed by North Korea, the very grave threat, as the president described it. He offered a 3-minute introduction. Mike Pence spoke a little bit. Then they handed it off to General Mattis, the defense secretary. And the lawmakers came away pretty underwhelmed. Many of the senators who attended the briefing were not willing to be quoted by name, but one described as a Republican said, well, as much as anything else, perhaps they wanted to prepare everybody for the fact that this could escalate quickly. That is my read on it. But others, including Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat of Connecticut, who was willing to be named, said there was very little, if anything, new. I remain mystified about why the entire Senate had to be taken over to the White House rather than conducting it here. Now, maybe that's just a turf gripe, but in a joint statement, the Secretary of State, Rexon Tillerson, Defense Secretary Mattis, and Dan Coats, the Director of National Intelligence, said that North Korea's pursuit of nuclear weapons is an urgent national security threat and top foreign policy priority, and yet they offered very little in the way of details about how they're going to confront this. And Tillerson is leaving, you know, tens of key positions unfilled at the State Department, and if diplomacy is the first choice, who are you going to call, Rex? There's a good analysis from Mark Landler in the New York Times today about the situation with Korea, and a good quote from Joel Witt, expert on North Korea at Johns Hopkins. He said, the reality is not as tense as the rhetoric on both sides would lead you to believe. And that the real change is that we're kind of used to Kim Jong-un being provocative, and now Trump is being provocative, and that creates unpredictability. So we still don't have a sense that this is an administration that does anything more than shoot from the hip and the lip, not interested in deep policies, not interested in creating complex negotiating structures to deal with a rogue nation like North Korea. They just want to wing it, and we will pay. I'm sorry to predict that, but I think we will. This just in from Afghanistan in, the 16th year of America's whatever war in the graveyard of empires. Two more American service members were killed in action Wednesday night in Nangarhar province. We don't have really any details, but this is the province where we deployed the mother of all bombs 2 weeks ago. And we, again, don't have details to see if there is any connection. Off the coast of Istanbul, a Russian naval intelligence ship called the Lyman was just at anchor or adrift in foggy conditions on the Black Sea when it was rammed by a merchant freighter loaded with sheep. Yes, the boat that survived this conflict is a Togo flag ship called the Usarsif H, and it had 8,800 head of sheep on it. That ship was unharmed, a little damage to the bow, but the Russian naval intelligence ship sank, and all 78 crew members were rescued. The Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPS, have penned another open letter expressing their skepticism on the alleged Syrian chemical incident on April 4th. Let me quote. They first cite that Defense Secretary Mattis held a joint news conference with Avigdor Lieberman, the defense minister of Israel, and they both flatly said that there is no doubt, there can be no doubt, that Syria has chemical weapons and used them on April 4th. The VIPS guys write, the Israeli intelligence followed on the heels of an April 13th speech given by CIA Director Mike Pompeo, who told an audience that once information had come in about a chemical attack on Khan Shaykhun, the CIA had been able to develop several hypotheses around that and then to begin to develop fact patterns which either supported or suggested that the hypotheses weren't right. So these intelligence professionals take that process to task. The danger of this rush toward an intelligence decision by Director Pompeo and National Security Advisor McMaster is that once the president and his top national security advisors have endorsed an intelligence-based conclusion and authorized military action based on that conclusion, it becomes virtually impossible for that conclusion to change. And they cite back in 2002, just 15 years ago, when Dick Cheney delivered a speech and said, "There is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt he is amassing them to use against our friends." And so this is where the veterans say, wait a minute. We see a pattern here. We see the same arrogance based on false confidence leading to unproven conclusions. One more quote. "While the jury is still out about whether or not Syria is like Iraq, telling the truth, or whether the suspicions of inspectors are well-founded, one thing is clear. A reasonable person would do well to withhold final judgment until all the facts are in." Well said, and I want to thank those veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, for injecting a little sanity into this debate. In a reprieve for abortion access in Louisiana, two of the last three abortion clinics will be able to stay open thanks to a federal judge who has permanently blocked a state law that would have led to their closure. This is another one of those laws that pretends to be about protecting women's health by demanding higher standards for abortion clinics, including hospital rights for the doctor, admitting privileges, they're called. But it's bullshit, and we know it. And Judge John de Gravels echoed that. "It is plain that Louisiana Law Act 620 would result in the closure of clinics, fewer physicians, longer waiting times, increased crowding, and increased associated health risks. Act 620 would do little or nothing for women's health, but rather would create impediments to abortion, with especially high barriers set for poor, rural, and disadvantaged women." I love to hear people tell the truth, especially when they speak with the power of a judicial authority. You can kiss goodbye to net neutrality. It'll take a little while for the new Republican boss of the Federal Communications Commission, Ajit Pai, to work it through the bureaucracy. But it's clear that probably by a year from now, we will see big operators like Netflix being able to negotiate discounted rates for data transmission from the big network providers. And that will create a multiple-tiered internet. And down the road, a little podcaster like me might have to pay higher rates, and my users, my listeners, might have to pay higher rates for the data you use to listen to this podcast, whether you stream it or download it. And this is a failure of the Obama administration to act on net neutrality during the first 2 years when they had majorities in Congress, because they had to rely on the FCC action that can now be unraveled by the next FCC chairman. And while the decision by Tom Wheeler, which I applauded, and which surprised me because I thought Tom Wheeler was a tool of the industry he had been picked to regulate by Obama, they set the standard that internet access is something that is akin to telephone service. It's a common carrier. We all have a right to access it on the same terms. And I believe that is a valuable standard, or it has been. And finally, United Airlines has signed into a secret settlement with Dr. David Dow, the Louisville doctor that they forcibly extracted from a flight at O'Hare just a couple of weeks ago. We don't know the terms of that settlement, but United Airlines is working on repairing their image. In a full-page ad today signed by their CEO, Oscar Munoz, headlined "Actions Speak Louder Than Words," they issue another apology, And then they set some new standards. Law enforcement will not remove customers from a flight. Customers will not be required to give up their seat once they're on board, except in matters of safety or security. In case of overbooking, we will identify volunteers much earlier and increase incentives up to $10,000 for rebooking. I might volunteer for 10 grand. And the one unexpected item here, we will eliminate the red tape on permanently lost bags with a new, no questions asked, $1,500 reimbursement. Now, I think that is a voluntary step that's not in reaction to bad publicity that makes a lot of sense, because the airlines are cumulatively generating profits of over $3 billion a year from baggage fees. And 10 years ago, nobody paid a fee for any bag. But it's a way they figured out they could extract more money from us without raising the nominal price of tickets, and they're doing it with abandon. And I've always felt that that's the task that the airlines perform worst. And to charge a fee for losing your bag is something that I've always thought was ridiculous. But at least with this, they're claiming if your bag is permanently lost, they will not wrangle or haggle with you. They'll just give you $1,500. Thanks for joining me for this news and comment podcast, available free every day and on YouTube. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.